Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Faith Saley really likes to do a good job. She was a straight-A student and a high school beauty queen who worked ahead to bake goodies to bring with her to the hospital when delivering her first child, so she would have something to share with the staff taking care of her in the maternity ward. Saley has worked overtime at everything she's ever attempted, including a never-right first marriage and an early acting career. She's won awards for pieces she's contributed to CBS Sunday Morning and devoted fans as a regular panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She even excelled, as she will wryly admit, at being an anorexic, because the one thing Saley didn't master young was the ability to be happy with herself. That lesson came later and more slowly, and it required a lot of trial and error and a characteristic amount of hard work. Faith Saley's new memoir is called Approval Junkie: Adventures in Caring Too Much. Faith, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you. That intro was, accurate and generous, but also I'm listening. I'm like, I'm a crazy person.
I did not mean to make you sound crazy.
No, that's not your. That was just my thought bubble. That's not yours.
What is the difference between an approval junkie and what somebody might call a pleaser or a perfectionist?
I think that a perfectionist is someone who doesn't dare try, right? A perfectionist won't leave the house without her makeup on. A perfectionist won't do something that might put her in a position of not doing it perfectly, obviously, or failing or embarrassing herself. Whereas I think an approval junkie is always willing to take a risk. At least in my case, I most of the times I've embarrassed myself have ended up either being very, very good stories to tell later or have made people laugh. And I think laughter or obviously applause or high fives to an approval junkie is a balm. And I think a people pleaser is someone who is probably condemned to mediocrity, right? Because we all know how hard it is to please everybody. As I say in the book, you know, if you're a people pleaser, you may end up working way too hard to impress your Uber driver because, as you know, Chris, they actually give you stars after you get out of the car. Did you know that?
I recently learned this, and I also learned
it's so upsetting.
Yeah, and you can't really give them a bad rating because they will get fired really quickly with just one or two of those.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought if you gave them a bad rating, the other drivers just would see that and wouldn't want to pick you up next time.
No,
good to know.
They can only get down to like 3 or 4 stars out of 5 before they are booted out.
Wow, talk about approval. See,
I know.
Approval is so important everywhere.
It is important everywhere.
I think in my definition of approval junkiness, the way it relates to me is you know the root of the word approve. I have spent a lifetime proving things, often to others, but mostly relentlessly to myself. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book and share these stories is that, I mean, it's not prescriptive. It's not telling people not to seek approval. I think it's such a fundamental human need, and I don't think it has disserved me. I think that many of the things that any of us do in the name of wanting to be understood or heard or loved are some of our most meaningful moments.
I'll admit I'm always a little skeptical when people tell me they don't care what anybody thinks.
Right?
I wonder if those people truly exist who actually don't care what anyone else thinks.
Dalai Lama maybe, or a psychopath. I don't know. I do think it's the people who say it the loudest or the most emphatically that probably care the most. I mean, people who might be running for president right now, or right? People who are like, I don't care about being politically correct, and yet, you know, as we know, elections are won and lost by approval ratings, or Kanye West. I think we're all stirred by the famous Sally Field moment back in 1985 when she said, "You like me right now, you like me." It's just so honest because, you know, we all want to feel that way.
Has there been a hierarchy for you as to whose approval mattered most at different times in your life?
Yeah. I'm tempted to start backwards because that's where I am now.
That's okay.
Yeah. I think the healthiest of us, we would all say that we seek our own approval. And I have, does this sound corny to say? I have a North Star now. I know I know enough when I've done a good job. I knew when I was writing this book, I knew after whatever, three drafts, oh, that's the way I wanted to say that. Mm. Or as Flaubert would say, le mot juste. You know, you search for the perfect word and it's so satisfying. And I know, like you, do interviews and you can tell me if you feel this way, Chris. There's this deeply satisfying feeling when you've had a conversation or drawn out a story from someone in a new way that you feel like not only connects you to the person you're interviewing, but you know has connected that person to countless listeners.
Yeah.
And you just, you know when that happened. You know when that happens.
And it doesn't happen every time.
It doesn't. And I do find, it's funny, when I interview people for CBS Sunday Morning, we are not looking at a clock like you have to. I mean, you have to be disciplined in your interviews. You have to keep a short leash on me. But when I interview people for that show, we have the luxury of being able to over-tape, right?
And, yeah.
and then go through a transcript and just pick and choose the best moments. And I find that when I'm doing an interview and I haven't approved of my own work in that interview. I haven't drawn out or gotten to the sweet spot or that really meaningful story. I keep talking. So you always know if it's a good interview, if it's shorter. If you tape for 3 hours, you know that, you know, I kept trying to get it out of this person. And speaking of Sunday Morning, that's a good example of people whose approval I think for me it's healthy to seek. I loved CBS Sunday Morning when I was a kid. I mean, it was on when we went to church. And when I was honored enough to work on the show and to meet the executive producer, I mean, I think my colleagues there are incredibly smart people. And when I get an email from Rand Morrison, who's the executive producer, saying, you know, nice work, or I really like that commentary, feels great. And I don't think there's any fundamental flaw in me for appreciating his approbation. I know that in my first marriage with I call him my husband in the book, that time in my life was a perfect storm of seeking approval from the wrong people and places. And that was seeking his, which I could never really get. And at the same time, I was having this acting career, which is just volunteering over and over, please, you know, to put yourself nakedly in front of people and say, please choose me, please choose yeah. me. Please think I'm the prettiest or funniest or thinnest or whateverest. And then, as you mentioned in your intro, seeking approval from numbers on a scale, those things don't work to make somebody, you know, grateful in the long term.
You say that you don't use a scale anymore. Did that help you gain control over your obsession? Or is there still, it sounds like you're still always really aware of the state of your body.
I am always aware of the state of my body. That I don't look at a scale. Do you, by the way? I'm always fascinated by people who can just hop on a scale and get off and be like, yeah, that's my number.
No, I don't, but for probably the exact opposite reason. Like, if I've gained weight, I don't want to just freak out about it. I just want to let it go. Not like forever till I have a problem, but I don't want to tie how I feel for the day about what the scale says.
You're so healthy. yes, that's if I could be like that, that would be great. I mean, look, your clothes don't lie. I know, you know, everyone's got their fat pants and you know how well they fit. I like working out. I like having a strong body. I like being athletic. And so, and I grew up dancing. And so I think with that just naturally comes body awareness. I like feeling my muscles work. I think that, you know, in the past 5 years, I've been pregnant 5 times and had 2 babies and spent 2 years of that breastfeeding. That makes you hyper connected to your body. Mm. And also was a 5 year, by the way, I mentioned this in my book, a word for 5 years is a lustrum. Isn't that a great word?
It's a great word.
Half a decade. So it was a lustrum of not really feeling like my body belonged to me, mm-hmm. Because I had to put certain things in it to make healthy babies or not put certain things in it. And when you're breastfeeding, you don't feel like your body belongs entirely to you. So I am still very aware of my body. And at I'm believe it or not, I'm solidly in middle age, I guess, if you do the math. I just turned 45, and I keep thinking there will be a day when I'm just released from wanting to be a thin person. But it doesn't work that way for me. And if that's going to be my vice or my cross to bear or my, you know, weirdness, then it's a fairly innocuous one. I try to keep it contained to myself and not let my children know that I care how much I weigh or how I look.
Well, one of those children, and maybe sex shouldn't matter, but one of your children is your daughter. How much do you think about the messages that she will get from, if not from you, from the rest of the world about how much her appearance matters?
Yeah. I honestly think she'll see me working out every day. You know, I'm not crazy. I go for a 45-minute run. Sometimes I take her in the jog stroller. And whenever my kids say, "Where are you going, Mommy?" or "Why are you sweaty?" I say, "I'm working out." And if they say why, I say it's to keep strong. And it really is now. I really have shifted to wanting to be strong and healthy for my kids as they enter adulthood and I enter a grave. But I don't, you know, she's two and she has this wonderful round belly and she just got glasses, which I just think are adorable. And she almost has no hair. Like, she's always wanted a ponytail and she has as much hair as like a 1 week old.
Yeah.
But it's so cool to see that it doesn't matter. And there's part of me that's like, is this an ellipse? Like ... When is she going to start? You know, I hope no one ever makes fun of her for her glasses, or I hope she doesn't start really, really wanting a braid or a ponytail soon. I don't know. I mean, Chris, did I read that you have four kids? Is that possible?
I do, and I have four teenagers, actually. You and I are the same age, but I started earlier.
Wow. Okay. So what do you do? I mean, is it just inevitable that particularly with girls, there's going to be this, and particularly with the social media nowadays, that there's just going to be this privileging and obsession with what they look like?
You know, I don't know, because mine definitely care about their appearance, but they're also both involved in sports. And I really feel like the messages, this sounds very corny and it comes by surprise to me, but the messages about, you know, you're playing sports because you want to keep your body healthy as opposed
strong.
To you want to look like this or that. And they both look great, but that's really not their primary kind of reason for staying fit. And I think that's fantastic.
Me too. I hope I instill that in my kids.
So you write with great love about your late mother, and we will talk about her, but you also say she was somewhat, is complicit the word you use, in your eating disorder?
Yeah. That sounds more damning than I wrote it, but it sounds more damning than it should. My mom was very active. She played tennis for like 3 hours a day competitively. She had a great body. It was really, really strong. She had a strong body. She grew up in Florida on the beach. She swam all the time, water skied. But she loved to eat, and she loved to exercise. So I did not grow up with a role model of – I grew up with a role model of someone who cared what she looked like but was in no way obsessed or counting calories. And, you know, I used to see her praying the rosary while doing her sit-ups. So she was disciplined, but she wasn't as nutty as I got. But, you know, she saw me, you know, when I talk about my struggles with my body, she saw me having that happen early on when I was a little girl and got kind of pudgy as I hit puberty. And I think she saw that I would be much happier if I lost weight. So she started walking with me, and that became a really nice ritual.
We're speaking this hour with Faith Saley. She's a contributor to CBS News Sunday Morning and a panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She's also host of the PBS show Science Goes to the Movies and author of the memoir Approval Junkie, Adventures in Caring Too Much. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Faith Saley. You may know her best as a panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She's also a contributor to CBS News Sunday Morning and host of the PBS show Science Goes to the Movies. Her new memoir is called Approval Junkie, Adventures in Caring Too Much. You can join us by sending us a tweet at KERA Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So tell us about your mom, who died when you were just 26, and what you've learned about her since you lost her that maybe you couldn't have understood in the moment.
Yeah, I was 26 when she died. She was my dearest friend. She was 52. She was 26 when her father died, and that happened a week before I was born, which is why my name is Faith and not Joy, as she had planned to name me. And, you know, I think that there's, I think when you become a parent, you have this, you're blindsided by this new understanding of your own parents, an understanding and also a million questions. Like, when you're little, it never occurs to you what your parents do after you go to sleep, you know? When you're
their
little,
their life ceases.
Right. I mean, they disappear, you know? When my parents, like most parents did, made me the focus of their days. And so as I have become a mother, you know, almost 20 years or almost 25 years after my own mother became a mother for the first time, 20 years, I have so many questions for her. And I have, you know, like, what did you do after we go to sleep? Was it hard for you? How did you have three kids at once? See, Chris, to you, that question means nothing. Four, but I have two.
No, I ask myself how I do it sometimes.
Okay. I have two. My son turns four tomorrow. My daughter just turned two. I don't, like, how does anybody do this? And how do you know if you're doing it right? And I just used air quotes because, of course, what you learn as a parent is that your child teaches you how to be his mother. Hmm. You know, there's no right way for every family, and even between children, there's a right way to raise your individual children because everyone has such unique needs. But I want to ask my mom if she had, you know, she seemed very, very satisfied to be a mother and a wife. She was what they called in the 70s a homemaker. You know, she volunteered teaching English as a second language. She worked at a rape crisis center. She taught Sunday school. She did, you know, my brother's Boy Scout troops. She did all that, but she didn't work. And I'd like to ask her if she wanted more than, if she ever wanted more than that. I wonder if she even dared let herself think she wanted more than that, or was she thoroughly satisfied in her 20s and 30s and 40s raising a family? I know that when I went back to college, she went back to get her master's in comparative religion because she was so fascinated by religions. I would come home from school. She was very Catholic. I was raised Catholic. I would come home from school and the Jehovah's Witnesses would be trying to leave. Like, she would invite them in, make them tea, and just, you know, just want to know everything about their religion. And they, you know, they had to go the next door, but she didn't want them to leave. And you know, when it came time for me to give birth, I wanted to know, you know, how long did you breastfeed? How did that feel for you? Did you get an epidural? And I asked these questions of my father, and he didn't know. But instead of just telling me I don't know or I don't remember, he seemed almost angry or annoyed that I asked him. And I think it's because he misses her. I think it's still very, very painful. And just he just found it annoying to have his 40-something daughter asking him those questions. But it was so upsetting for me. There's just I don't even know if my mom started menopause when she died. Especially when you're a woman, there's so much history that you want to know about your mother. And I just don't know. I only know the woman she was until she died. And I know the mother she was to me. But I want to know the whole person she was and what her dreams were. And I'll never really know.
Do you think you'd be able to ask her every... It sounds like you were incredibly close, but you note that, you know, sometimes, and your dad's a good example of this, you can ask questions of strangers when you are interviewing someone that are harder to ask people that you're really close to.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Do you find that too?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I feel like there's a agreement when you sit down across from somebody in an interview. For the most part, people, except when I interviewed Nick Cannon a week before he married Mariah Carey, and his people were like, "Don't say the word Mariah." But there's an agreement that if I'm really listening, if I'm showing you that I'm really listening, and I'm asking you meaningful questions, then you are probably going to let me ask you anything. And if you feel, you, the guest, the interviewee, feels comfortable enough and understood and heard and safe, you will probably answer. It's almost like I've found it to be a superpower. I love interviewing people. It's such a generous exchange of spirit, I think. And yes, it is so much harder to ask questions of my father. I think it's also a generational thing, you know? I think our generation and those younger than us are just used to an open society and people being more forthcoming. But I do, to answer your question, Chris, I do think I could have asked my mother anything because I did. I mean, we were incredibly close.
In sharing your ideas about how to do a good interview, you say that it can actually work to talk through disagreements with your husband as though you were interviewing him. Explain how and why that's helpful to your relationship. I've not tried this one.
Okay, I'm not always good at it. But, you know, when I sit down to interview people, it is not my job, nor is it my goal to persuade them of something. It is my job to ask them questions that elicit thoughtfulness on their part and to listen and to absorb and not to interrupt them. And so when I'm having an argument or some tension with my husband, and again, I'm not always very good at this, if I can think, you know what, calm down, pretend this is an interview, and just listen to him. Don't interrupt him. And if he says something you don't agree with, maybe ask him why. Maybe try to understand it a little bit more. I mean, if I sat down with someone who is a rabid Trump supporter right now, I would not spend my time with him or her. Let's just say him. I would not spend my time with him trying to convince him that I don't agree with him. I would be way more fascinated finding out why he wants to vote for Donald Trump, for example. So I find this to be helpful when I disagree with my husband and not to sort of wait until he stops talking just so I can convince him that he's wrong and I'm right.
What would you ask Donald Trump?
That's a great question, and the trouble with that question is that it almost doesn't matter. I would ask him how I would line up all the things he said that are so demeaning about women, and I would read them to him, and I would say, how can you say these things and say that you are a great supporter of women? But the trouble with that, Chris, is that it's not going to sink in. He's not going to say, oh, yeah, you're right. You just lined up all the evidence, and I'm really deeply misogynistic. Although maybe it would be fun to ask him, because it's amazing to see how he can sort of deflect any kind of criticism. What would you ask him?
I want to see what's underneath the performance, if there is a core that is different from the public persona. So I'm not exactly sure how I would get to that. But
I wonder what
I'm
the question
about.
Would be. Maybe you would ask him have you ever been scared? Have you ever been scared? Or when's the last time you cried? You know, something like that.
I know Megyn Kelly tried some of that, but maybe we can all band together and try to ask some more, some deeper things.
I don't know how hard she tried.
All right, let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. We have Doug on the line in Rockwall. Hi, Doug.
Yes. Hi, Chris. Really intrigued by the subject. But first, a comment. I think just a personal opinion, but I think wait, don't tell me has got the dialogue and writing of the script. I think is as clever as the old days of Steve Allen. Now you may be too young to remember him.
No, Doug. I did a musical that Steve Allen wrote. He wrote a musical version of A Christmas Carol, and I was in it, and he was very, very old, and he would sit backstage and eat one banana a show, and one time he fell asleep on the banana.
Well, he was arguably a brilliant man, wrote one show in dactylic hexameter just for the heck of it.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you very much, but Doug, did I hear you say the script of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? Did I hear you say that?
Well, some of it seems scripted, but I know it gives the effect of being very much, I mean, the side comments, I should probably say. Surely you all start with something, or maybe you're so brilliant it comes on the fly. I don't know.
How does it work? Peter and the brilliant, it's a very small shop to produce that much funny every week. There are three main producers that Peter works with, and they have a working script, like a skeleton, like we're going to talk about this subject now and this subject now. But absolutely everything the panelists do is improvised, absolutely everything, except the Bluff the Listener. The night before the show, we tape on Thursday. So on Wednesday nights, the three panelists get an email that says, this is your topic. And they will send a link to the real story. And they'll say, you know, so-and-so, Paula, you have the real story this week. And Faith and Mo, you go make up a ridiculous story about X. And so we write that ahead of time. And then about an hour before the show, we get the question for the prediction at the end of the show. Like, you know, who's Donald Trump going to name for his running mate? And you get about an hour to come up with a joke. But everything else is completely improvised.
Well, let's let people listen to a little bit in case they do not tune in on weekends and are ready to start. Here we go.
Now, panel, how will Hillary convince Bernie to drop out? Finally, Paula Poundstone.
She'll offer to do a fundraiser for him.
Adam Felber.
She will accede to his demand of the basic proposition that everyone should pay their taxes, but nobody should pay retail.
And Faith Saley.
She'll bribe him by promising to make him a better Ben & Jerry's flavor called Feel the Churn.
Do you ever...
That was just okay.
Well, do you ever worry that someone else will have your punchline?
Oh, you mean like somewhere in media that week?
Well, no, someone else...
Oh, you mean on the panel.
On the panel has written the same joke.
We very occasionally say them to each other backstage mm-hmm. to make sure no one's done that. I have to tell you, one time Tom Baudet and I had basically the same joke. That man is the menschiest. He is such a gentleman. Of course, he was like, oh, you take it, and then thought up another one on the fly. But Adam Felber is, you know, he writes for Bill Maher, and he's such a good comedy writer. So a lot of times he actually helped me shape that prediction because I didn't really have a good one. So sometimes we give each other help. It's not ruthlessly competitive backstage, I can assure you of that. We're all just really happy to see each other.
How much do you have to let go of worrying that every single thing you say is going to be the funniest, most brilliant thing?
Yeah, when I started the show, my gosh, it's been, it's been almost 7 years, and I'm still one of the new kids. When I started the show, I wanted to be really funny, and I wanted to say a lot of jokes. And then I would listen to it the weekend it came out and think, you know, I'd hear it edited, and I think, oh, but I had a joke there, and I had a joke there, and no one's ever going to know because I cut them out. And I very... very quickly realized that it's a team. You're playing on a team. And, you know, some of the people on the team, for example, Paula Poundstone, are just unbelievably brilliant comedians. And her brain works on a different level. I mean, her line of humor doesn't even necessarily riff on the week's news, right? I mean, she's like inviting you into this hilarious, irascible monologue going on in her head. And once I got comfortable enough knowing that, okay, I'm not auditioning anymore, I'm going to be invited back next month and next month and next month, I could just enjoy the show. And again, it's that feeling we were talking about before where you give yourself approval. You feel deeply satisfied when you're part of a team and you're laughing at each other's jokes and you're tagging each other's jokes. And I have found that my very, very best jokes have always come in the moment and been completely spontaneous. I mean, I do come to the show each week at Wait, Don't Tell Me with I know, like, okay, these were the three big stories this week, and do I have anything funny to say about this that I haven't already heard somebody say on The Daily Show or Stephen Colbert say or something? Because that's also a challenge. And so I might try to use a joke I've thought up ahead of time, but it's always more satisfying if something comes out of the moment.
So the whole teamwork idea didn't really come after you visited Bill O'Reilly, although it sounds like the first time you were on his show, it was like an awesome first date, and then the second time, it was like that second date where you think, what was I attracted to last time?
Well, on our second date, he invited another lady along. And I thought, yeah, it was a few summers ago, and I was asked to come on his show, and the producers had this great idea that I would be recurring, and I'd be, you know, the spunky liberal gal. And I just thought Bill O'Reilly and I would become the Benedict and Beatrice of Fox News. I thought, you know, he'd be calling me Saley, like he does with all the ladies he likes. And the first time it was just he and I, and I had a bunch of jokes planned, and he interrupted me a ton, which I expected, but I made him smile, and it went well enough that he asked me back for a second date, or his producers booked me. But then they said, Bill wants to try something with someone else, and her name was Juliet, and she was tall and tan and blonde, and he wants you to do a segment with him. And I thought, well, I think it's a little soon to bring someone into this relationship, but I'm game. And they came up with this idea that it would be this ongoing thing called the I think it was just called the dumbest thing of the week. And I don't know if it's like this on absolutely every news outlet, but on most of them, and certainly on Fox, they want you to tell them what you're going to talk about. They don't like surprises. And if you're a comedian or you would like to offer something funny, that's really a bummer because, like I said, the best things happen in the moment, and you really don't want someone reading your jokes ahead of time. It kind of deflates them. So they had told us that what Bill O'Reilly was going to say was the dumbest thing of the week, and it was a ding against President Obama. And, you know, I said what I thought was the dumbest thing, and then I spent the rest of the day before I went on his show preparing by calling the White House press office because I knew someone there. And you know, at least in my mind, thoroughly discrediting what Bill O'Reilly was going to say about Obama. And I thought, you know, I'm going to spring this on him on the show and demonstrate that I'm a bona fide journalist and not just like a funny liberal girl. And when I did that, he was so unhappy. And he looked at me. It was the end of a segment, just like right now. It's the end of a segment. I hear the music. And he said, and you believe that? I said, well, Bill, the White House press office told me that. He said, well, you believe that? No wonder your name is Faith. And then it went to commercial, and I was just like, I like slunk out of the studio, and he never asked me for another date.
Faith Saley is with us. We're talking about her new memoir, Approval Junkie, Adventures in Caring Too Much. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with CBS News Sunday Morning contributor and NPR Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist Faith Saley. Her new memoir is called Approval Junkie, Adventures in Caring Too Much. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I love this story about you. In high school, you set your sights on winning this pageant. And what I love about it is that you sort of knew that you wouldn't win freshman or sophomore year, that you really kind of had to be an upperclassman, but you threw your hat in the ring every single year, still hoping that you might win every single year.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I needed a place to wear my cobalt blue unitard. You know, I was okay with paying my dues. I mean, I was okay with laying the groundwork and the goodwill so that come 1989, my senior year in high school, I would be crowned Miss Aphrodite, goddess of beauty and love. This at a public school.
It doesn't sound like a really feminist contest.
No, my school is, I think that school is now a charter school. I have a feeling they have sadly done away with Miss Aphrodite. But as I say in the book, if you're surprised that a public school had a beauty pageant for its girls, then your people were probably on the chilly side of the war of Northern aggression. It was, you know, my school didn't have a drama program, and I was an actor. I started acting when I was 11, and I was one of those, like, you know, teenagers doing Andrew Lloyd Webber and neutered versions of Sondheim and jazz squares with a little musical touring company. And so this Miss Aphrodite pageant was the only way I could show my classmates and my teachers what I could do. And what I could do was, you know, belt loudly and over-emote. but, you know, I wasn't on drill team and I wasn't a cheerleader. I was like, you know, I was an honor student. And then as soon as the bell rang, I'd grab my character shoes and go downtown to my rehearsals. And so that's why this pageant meant so much to me. And, of course, so it was mostly a talent pageant. But, of course, since it's Miss Aphrodite, Goddess of Beauty and Love, it was also this, you know, external validation of my high school attractiveness, or at that point, really, how high I could get my hair.
Do you still define yourself as a performer?
Yeah, I do. I think there is an element of perform. Well, certainly on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Yeah.
And I think there is an element of performing to being a good, you know, TV journalist on air interviews. I hope that as you ask me that, I wonder if that makes it sound disingenuous, because truly when you do a good interview, the spotlight is not on you. But certainly when I do my commentaries and my opinion pieces for Sunday Morning. But I will say that I miss it. I was recently having this conversation with an actor friend of mine. And, you know, I was an actor from the time I was 11 until I moved to New York on this improbably itinerant career path I've had, where I moved. I'd never hosted a radio show at all. And when I was 35, I got this job hosting a national public radio show for Public Radio International. And I moved to New York and started doing that. And since then, with the exception of one pilot I did, where I played the mother. I had just put my 39-year-old eggs on ice. Uh-huh. I was not a mother yet, and I just put my eggs on ice, and I flew to L.A. to play the mother of a high school student who was a 22-year-old with a receding hairline, because that's Hollywood for you. Anyway, with the exception of that one part, I have not done any acting, and I deeply miss it. When I go see a Broadway musical, this sounds so corny, but my heart kind of hurts. I mean, I was a musical theater kid and adult, and never expected to be doing anything else. Even when I was, you know, at a great college, and even when I got my master's in literature in England, you know, very, you know, fancy academic creds, I never thought of myself as anything other than an actor who loved to read and write. And I miss it. And there's been something about turning 45, I turned last month, where I really recognize, like, I can't avoid it. I'm really in middle age, and I'm probably not going to star in a Broadway show. It really kind of struck me. I mean, maybe, but it I miss it. It hurts a little when I go see a Broadway show. I really want to be up there.
It is interesting. I talked to someone who wrote a really interesting book of essays a year or two ago, and he noted that acting is the only art form that really requires someone else to give you permission to do it, right? You can dance in an empty
yes.
studio. You can paint all day, and you may never
you
get
write.
Discovered.
Yeah.
You can write, but if you want to act, someone has to say you're good enough to do it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
not that you're not good enough to do it, but, it, you know, there's a million things at play there.
Yeah, yeah. There's that, and that's why it was a perfect profession for an approval junkie.
Hmm.
And when, you know, and I had ticked off all these achievements my whole life, things were rolling along. Just, you know, I mentioned this in the chapter about my high school pageant. It, you know, as a kid, the world seems, for most of us, for the lucky kids, the world seems pretty just, right? You behave well, you study hard, you make good grades, you get to go to a good school. You know, your parents are proud of you. And it just seems kind of linear. And then I didn't know. It was so crushing to leave grad school and go to L.A. and have been successful acting in college and in grad school. And then go to L.A. and just not. I mean, I had some success. I mean, you know, I was on Star Trek and I got beamed up. I don't mean to
I saw
cry,
actually a great picture of you online in the uniform and everything. It was really
yes.
cool.
But, you know, I didn't have the success that I had envisioned, and that was crushing. And I, you know, I write at the end of that chapter. You can hear me. There's my book. I write at the end of that chapter about my pageant. I say, I say I love casually telling people I won my high school pageant in the Northeast in this century. It sounds positively exotic. and I faux brag about being Miss Aphrodite 1989 because it's so ridiculous. But the truth is, I have a wistfulness about it. I remember it clearly as one of the last times I set goals to dominate my body and to captivate the student body, certain I could achieve them through sheer determination. And that's a faith that belongs to the young, because you grow older and you learn soon enough that life doesn't work that way. And wishing hard and working hard don't always stick a crown atop your ephemerally skinny body.
And it didn't, you know, in terms of dominating your body, this is a strange leap to make maybe, but when you decided it was time to have a child, it wasn't something that you could just do because you wanted it badly enough or you were good enough.
Yeah. Although when my fertility doctor, God bless her, I thank her in the back of the book because she gave me half the book she gave me to write about. Mm. She did say to me, "You're doing a really good job. You're doing what most people don't do," which is to say, I went to her when I was 38. I'd never been pregnant. I was single. I was separated from my husband. I was on the way to getting a divorce, my first husband. And I said to her, somebody told me to go see you. I want to be a mother. Let's do this. Let's figure this out. And I went through all these tests, and I found out I had this exceptional uterus, which is to say really screwy. It had the septum running down the middle of it. And she was like, you've never been pregnant because you couldn't sustain a pregnancy. Let's do this surgery. So I did that by myself. And then the next year, I was still single. And she said, you know what? Unless you're ready to be a single mother right now, why don't you freeze your eggs? So I was 39. And I started that process. It just so happens I met the man who is now my husband, John. Our first date was the night before I started freezing my eggs. Hmm. So our courtship was full of doctor-ordered pelvic rest. And and in our wedding vows, I said to him, I knew you were the one when you let me put my syringe in your refrigerator. And then, you know, I was dogged about it. I mean, true to sort of my character, I was like, I'm going to harness science for all it can do. And I will do IVF as many times as it takes to become a mother. And I'm still lucky because I know some people try that or either don't have the funds or try that and it doesn't happen for them. But I remember telling my doctor, I'm so lucky. I'm so grateful for you and I'm so lucky. And she said, you know what? A lot of women don't try as hard as you did. And it felt as great as when she would tell me I had amazing ovaries. I was an ovary achiever. So I did sort of apply my work ethic to motherhood as much as I could, becoming a mother, I should say.
What kind of pressure does it put on a burgeoning relationship to tell somebody on like date one or two, I'm just back from freezing my eggs?
Right. Well, by the time I met my husband, John, we had been, we always say we met through gay date because his gay best friend and my gay best friend set us up. And it was such a curated, bespoke kind of introduction. The minute I met him, I was like, this is a great guy. A friend of mine, actually the one who wrote that pilot I was telling you about, when I first started dating John, my friend knew I was very excited about this man. And I happened to mention that my husband, John, is Jewish. And so my friend announced that I was undergoing the JSAP, the Jewish Semen Acquisition Project, which ended up being successful. But, you know, by the time I met John, I knew he had been divorced. I knew I had been divorced. We were both 39. So my hat was off to this man who wanted to date age appropriately, because you usually don't meet 39-year-old men who want to date a 39-year-old woman who wants to have a baby.
Right.
And on our first date, we talked about dead parents and we talked about divorce, and I told him I want to be a mother. Are you interested in having kids? I mean, it wasn't a proposition right there in the moment. I mean, maybe. But but he said yeah. He said he thought that ship had sailed. Hmm. And my mind, I'm like, oh, just you wait, mister. I got some things on ice for you. But the next day he texted me, hey, had a great time last night. Where are you right now? And I took a deep breath, and my BlackBerry, that's how long ago it was, my BlackBerry was under the table, and I typed, I'm at an orientation at NYU for freezing my eggs, because there was no emoji for that at the time. There probably is now. and he made it like a open mouth, like an, oh my gosh, face. And then it was effortless. He was, this is my husband. He's unflappable. And so it wasn't uncomfortable, because by the time I met him, and, you know, I think the universe works this way. By the time I met him, I had already decided I was going to be a mom, however it happened. And so inviting him into that picture was more than I could have hoped for. But I didn't have this urgency to make sure he was a father of my children.
Would you have done it alone?
Yeah, it's really easy to say that, because now that I've done it with him, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so hard.
Yeah.
But I was planning. I was figuring it out. I was thinking I would move to D.C. and live with my brother and his husband if I were to be a single mom, and I would commute to do Sunday morning stories, and I'd commute to Chicago for Wait, and I'd make sure they had a good public school so I could afford it. It is very easy for me to say I would have done it alone, but I really think I would have. I do not make motherhood the primary. I'm not one of those people who wants to be thought of as like a mother first. I'm a person first, and I didn't want to write a mommy book, but I knew I wanted. I had to be a mom, and part of it I see now was also healing from losing my own mother at a young age. I still miss her, but I don't think I ever would have really stopped grieving her the way that I did until I became a mom.
As a parent, how much do you want your children to seek your approval?
You know, approval is a developmental milestone. It really is. It's not just me deciding that. and that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book with this theme, almost a little bit of a defense of seeking approval, because you see it in your kids, and you've got teenagers. So, mm-hmm. Do they still seek your approval? Surely they're seeking their peers, but do they seek yours?
They do in different ways. It is not that they don't all have the same standard, but yes,
right. And I have little kids, and it's obvious. They love it when I clap for them or tell them how lovely they look, or you know, give them kisses, or say, oh, you know, it's very, you're so observant, Augustus. You know, by the way, parenthood these days, you know, you're supposed to be very careful with compliments, right? You're supposed to praise effort,
smart,
not
right.
Achievement.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. You're not. I can't tell you you're smart or pretty, but I'll think of something else to say. I know. I started thinking I could tell my son he was clever. And I was like, no, that's not going to work. You know, we get to this point somewhere along the line. We're magically supposed to shed our appreciation of validation. And at this point for my kids, I would no sooner deprive them of validation than I would of their vegetables. It's assuming that parents want the best things for their children seeking their approval is a pretty healthy thing, right? If my kid comes home with straight A's, I'm going to be like, that's great. You worked really hard. Not you're so smart. but yeah, there has to come a time where kids separate enough from their parents to recognize that their parents aren't always right. And look, I was lucky. I have no problem seeking my parents' approval. I was lucky enough to be raised by parents who wanted me to do whatever I wanted to do. They were quite sanguine about my wanting to be an actor. I wouldn't tell my kids they had to be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. My father has always said to me, I'm impressed but not surprised, which I think is like the greatest kind of validation.
Faith Saley's new memoir is called Approval Junkie, Adventures in Caring Too Much. Faith, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for making this time for us.
Oh, Chris, I can't thank you enough. I hope it was okay.
It was great. I hope I was okay.
Think you were.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Javier Girbet. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.